Welcome to The Neutral Ground. This week, I'm excited to say we have two wonderful guests for our program. First, Dr. Kimberly Max Brown. Max is Executive Director of Eternal Soldier, a volunteer organization that promotes programs, public speaking events, workshops, and book groups for veterans on military history and service, biography, famous narratives, battlefield technology, myth, and art. Max is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate Group in Art and Archaeology of the Mediterranean World, and a museum consulting scholar. Eternal Soldier combines her passion for ancient cultures, especially ancient Rome, with her devotion to veterans. We're also joined by Dr. Sheila Murnahan, known as Bridget. Bridget teaches in the Department of Classical Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her main areas of interest are Homer, Greek, tragedy, gender in classical culture, and modern receptions of classical texts. She is currently completing a new translation for a Norton Critical Edition of Sophocles' Antigone. In this episode, Max, Bridget, and I talk about a myriad of topics related to heroism and what it means to be a warrior. We grapple with how to read Odysseus as a leader of his men, and the complexity of Penelope as both warrior and the spouse at home in the Odyssey. Both Max and Bridget have taught the Odyssey multiple times, so I get the chance to wax poetical with them a little bit about one of my favorite characters from Homer's epic that few have heard of, the great Elpenor, a character that I think is quite important for us to know about in today's culture. We also bring in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings to discuss the role that memory of home plays in the warrior's ability to come back home. This is truly a fascinating episode that you're going to want to dive right into and just kind of stay with to the very end. Now, if you're a veteran struggling to find your feet under you, check out the links below in the episode notes, and don't be hesitant about reaching out for some help. No war has ever been won by a single soldier. It's okay to reach out for some help in this battle. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Max Brown and Dr. Bridget Murnahan. Max, Bridget, welcome to The Neutral Ground. How are you both doing today?
Okay. Doing really good.
Excellent. So before we get into the specifics of this wonderful Eternal Soldier program, I would like to begin by setting up a bit of context here for the audience so that they can understand how we're going to get to something like a discussion of veterans reading Homer. So I would love to begin by asking each of you to just talk a little bit about what it was that got you excited and curious or interested in your respective fields.
So I'll go first. So what started for me, I'm an archaeologist. What started my interest, I think, was just happenstance. I had a chance to go to Temple University's program in Rome. For a variety of reasons, I fixed it so that I had a whole semester of electives. And I wound up spending about 6 months in Italy. And I took a course with a professor in Rome who's still teaching and still excavating. And it opened my mind to things that I just had never considered. And I also think that I had a particular knack for it. And he was like, wow, you're very, very good at this. And then after I graduated, I was very close to graduating at that point. So I went ahead and finished my degree in journalism. But after I graduated, I was sort of confronted with the opportunity to take more classes. And when I took those classes again, people were like, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you involved in this? So I took them at their word. So.
Yeah, I would say also there, it was, I think, a combination of just chance. And then at a certain moment, you get kind of hooked. But I happened to go to the kind of school where they taught Latin and even a little bit of Greek. So I had sort of a head start on the ancient languages. And I definitely, without really even articulating to myself, I think I found language fascinating, and learning foreign languages and all of the questions that raises. But I went off to college without any thought that that's the direction I would go. And kind of in my freshman year, I realized that although I had thought I was going to major in something involving what I thought of as the big ideas, like philosophy, that literature was really what I loved. Because I had done some with ancient languages, I sort of continued doing that. And honestly, I think that studying ancient literature set me apart a little bit. I went to college long enough ago that there were loads and loads of English majors. And I thought that being a classics major would make me a little different. And I think, and then, you know, once I got going, the texts were so interesting and so beautiful. I mean, then it kind of just snowballed.
Yeah, absolutely. My I think I've told this before on the podcast too, with my own journey. I was originally a music major, and then I was did my associate degree in computer science. But in that associate degree, I actually took a short story course, and we read Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener. And there was, if you're familiar with the text at all or not, the character is this, the famous line is, the character says, "I would prefer not to." And that's kind of his answer to any question that's given to him from about the middle of the book to the end. The lawyer, his boss, asks him to do something, and he says, "I would prefer not to." And that line just drove me crazy. I thought, what does that mean? And what is the problem with this character, with Bartleby? And that was enough for me to know, I have to study this. I have to figure out what is going on with Bartleby.
Exactly.
And I never did.
It's that ability to put something incredibly important in a resonant phrase that makes
absolutely
literature kind of get under your skin, I think. Yeah.
It really did. Well, let me ask you both this. I'll start with Max. I'll start with you. Does your study of ancient cultures, does that influence your approach to modern day problems?
Wow. In a variety of ways. So, you know, Eternal Soldier is, you know, it's not my day job. I wish it were, but it's not my 9-to-5. So my 9-to-5 is steeped in daily problems, like steeped in everyday right now problems with veterans of every stripe trying to get healthcare. And so I should say that before I get started, these views I'm about to let you know about are my own. I'm a federal employee, so they are not those of the federal government or the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. So I am, I work at the VA. I work with veterans every day. I work for veterans every day. And again, I'm steeped in a host of problems that veterans face when they're trying to get healthcare, when they're trying to stay healthy, trying to figure out like what's the best route for them to deal with some of the after effects of their military service, particularly if they experience combat. I will say that working in medicine, the ways that people, like, so I don't mean to put you on the spot, Bridget, but I should let Joe know that I took a class with Bridget when I was in medical school. And some of the ways that she taught me to think about, I took a class on gender with Bridget. Some of the ways that she taught me to think about gender, I still do think that way. And certainly that kind of overview, that wider view of putting yourself in someone else's shoes and using literature as one of the inroads to do it, and just being able to see things from a variety of perspectives has been instrumental in my success at the VA. I would say that having a really deep immersion into the humanities in general, you know, I've studied anthropology, I've studied classics, I've studied ancient history, I've studied art history, a lot of different ways of looking at culture, and bringing that breadth of viewpoints and techniques and methodologies has been very, very helpful for me because I can get doctors to think about things in ways that they just haven't thought to consider, you know, the net of relationships that a veteran may be a part of. We call that intersectionality now, but there, when I got started, there wasn't a clear term for that, or at least not one accepted by the medical establishment. And so that, I mean, we are taught as humanists to think in a variety of ways about a person and what may or may not be going on with them. And that's not exactly the case in medicine. So yeah, I would definitely say that.
Oh, there's so many ways. I'm just trying to think. There's so many ways to answer that. And I think, it's true in a lot of different ways. I mean, I've certainly found in my personal life that every now and then something I read in an ancient text just really resonated and was helpful. I think, for example, of the end of the Iliad, where it ends with a meeting between two people, both of whom are grieving. But one sort of turns to the other and talks about the importance of moving beyond grief. And I know that for me has been really helpful at moments when I found myself inclined to move beyond grief and, you know, had those sort of feeling, you know, when I'd lost someone and had those feelings of, oh, what's wrong with me? I'm getting on with my life. And then when I remember that, like, Achilles was telling Priam that that's what you have to do, I found that really, really helpful. I think the ancient world is a really valuable distant mirror for thinking about ours. And Max brought up the issue of gender. I have found that, I mean, teaching about gender in ancient Greece, which was an extremely gender polarized society, more so than our own, allows you to see in a kind of heightened and clarifying way the ways in which people split the world up between male and female. And I've found that a great course to teach because you never have to push the modern parallels with the students. They always at some point say, well, you know, yeah, but you know, it's not really that different now when they're talking about basic expectations about what makes, you know, male and female different. And then I think, you know, the humanities, studying literature is often studying how things are said indirectly. You know, how does a story make a point by just seeming to simply tell a story, which I think is very, very helpful for the kind of interpreting what's going on with other people that Max was talking about. So there's more I could say, but that's mm-hmm. probably enough.
No, that's wonderful.
Yeah,
recently I reread, maybe just a year ago or so, I reread The Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And of course, anytime you get to reread a classic, something sticks out, something new. And do you know what jumped out at me this time? Elpenor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's so funny. I love talking about Elpenor because I always, you know, phrase it in kind of a joking way, you know, whether it's the students or even my own colleagues. I'll say, of course, you've heard of the epic story of Elpenor. And of course, no one knows who Elpenor is.
Right.
But the reason why, for those who may not know, Elpenor is part of Odysseus's crew. And of course, please correct me if I get anything incorrect here. Part of Odysseus's crew, he's on Circe's island with them. And he gets drunk and falls asleep on the roof of the palace, falls and breaks his neck and dies right there. Now, later on, when Odysseus is in the underworld, he sees Elpenor, and Elpenor says, "You left me there. I'm unburied. You have to go back, and you have to take care of this. Take care of me." And normally, where I would have just been focusing on Odysseus or Penelope or something else, I just stopped. I stopped reading right there, and I said, "Oh my goodness. Think of what this is telling us about the Elpenors in our stories. Are there people, are there things that we have maybe not consciously forgotten or didn't take care of, but things that we can go back and address or readdress or in some way, or even just thinking going forward, how we treat others in our stories, because we tend to call them our stories, right? And here is this ancient text right in our face telling us there are Elpenors in every story, and you have to be aware of them. And I just thought that was so powerful to me in that moment that I don't know how many times people have brought up Elpenor to both of you, you know, but it just, it made me think, and I'm curious, are there, and this doesn't have to be just the Homer's texts, but are there any particular stories or ideas or artifacts that have spoke to you in a rereading or relooking at of things as well?
I think there are always surprises when you reread something. And I often ask people who are like reading the Odyssey for the second time, you know, what surprised you this time? And I'm thinking there's a wonderful poem cycle by the poet Linda Paston called Rereading the Odyssey in Middle Age. And she talks about reading the Odyssey and being surprised that Penelope was weaving a shroud for her father-in-law, because what she remembered when she read it as a young woman, that she was weaving a lovely shawl that she would get to wear. And, you know, that difference between a young woman's reading and an older woman's reading is, it really captures that sense of surprise when you go back. And one of the poems in that cycle also begins with a line that I was thinking of when you were speaking about Elpenor, which is, there's always a story that nobody bothers to tell. And I think one of the great things about the Odyssey is that it is relentlessly Odysseus focused. It is his story told to come out the way that is best for him. And yet it includes all of these other characters, and it doesn't fully tell their stories. In fact, it leaves some of them quite, enigmatic. But it gives the material for imagining other stories. And of course, there's this very rich history of people who've come along and done that. I didn't answer that myself, but I think it's a great phenomenon. Yeah.
No, I just feel, you know, poor Elpenor.
Didn't he just come up in one of our groups? Yeah.
Is that right?
I think one of our veterans we were reading with had that same.
Right.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, one thing that is so interesting is what strikes readers at different periods of time. So, for example, now I think it's very, very hard to be involved in a discussion of the Odyssey in which one of the things that comes up isn't one of the things that comes up isn't the 12 slave women who are very brutally punished by Telemachus in the wake of Odysseus's triumph. That's a passage, and that's now, I think that's something that's much discussed. It plays those women have a very strong and powerful voice, one that is in fact stronger in the end than Penelope's in Margaret Atwood's retelling of the Odyssey, the Penelopeiad. And yet, you know, mm-hmm. until, you know, fairly recently, I don't think anyone particularly focused on that passage. Reading the Iliad, my students now often bring up the passage where Briseis, the war prize over whom, Achilles is fighting with Agamemnon, mourns Patroclus, the comrade of Achilles who dies in the course of the war. And her expression, her lament is now a passage that really, really speaks to readers. But again, I think it's one that wasn't particularly foregrounded in earlier discussions.
Yeah, I never actually thought about that until you just mentioned it, that connection between the two of them. I'm actually going to have to go back and look at it myself.
Yeah, it's in book 19. She gives a very interesting lament over Patroclus. Yeah.
Why do you think that is, if you don't mind me asking? Because I want to make our move toward the Eternal Soldier program. But I am curious, you really got me on this. Why the lament? I never thought about it.
Lament is actually, I think, sort of, underlies the Iliad to an extent that we don't always recognize. And of course, lament is traditionally a genre associated with women. And, you know, the Iliad has, you know, sorrow over death and war as sort of part of its framework. And so it doesn't give a lot of space to women's lamenting voices, but they are very, very powerful when they are included. And in fact, the poem ends with three laments for Hector by his mother, his wife, and by Helen, the woman that they've all been fighting over. And so I think you see that lament is a genre that, I mean, we think of epic as a genre totally focused on male glory and the celebration of achievement in war. And that is definitely an important part of it. But these expressions of sorrow for those who lose their lives in war, which include some real critiques of the idea that risking your life for glory is really worth it, are also there, present.
Yeah. And of course, it's Thetis, his own mother, who gives him that outline. She understands more than anyone that you have two paths in front of you and you've got to make this choice. And she lays it out so clearly for him. You can stay and win your glory in war and your narrative that will live on forever, or you can go home and live a long life, but it will end and you will not have that glory, but you'll have a comfortable existence. And I found it just in my own research in early American lit, when Stephen Crane writes The Red Badge of Courage, he focuses it in on the Iliad, and he has this moment where the young soldier, Henry Fleming's mother, gives him the same choice, except what Crane does that's interesting is Fleming had already signed up for the Civil War before speaking with her. And so she has to do this kind of after the fact, you know, because that kind of authority was taken away from her to be able to help and to give insight that she clearly has. She even tells Fleming, I can give you 1,000 reasons why there's more glory in staying home on the farm. And that is a beautiful modernist move by Crane to say, in modernism, in the wake of the atrocities of World War I, we have to rethink what glory actually looks like, and that you can find glory in home, in the community, in the self, and what you do. There's honor and integrity there. And maybe that might be a great way in then to the wonderful Eternal Soldier program here as well, right? Because you do a lot of that movement as well, relocation and rethinking about this. Can I first ask, Max, maybe could you give us a little bit of an introduction to the program for the audience?
Oh, sure. Eternal Soldier is, how can I put it? It's a platform more than a single program. So it's like we are a volunteer collaborative composed of veterans, scholars like Bridget, and clinicians. And what we do is we, you know, like to look at previous history, previous conflicts, and we like to refashion them so that veterans can engage with that material. So we sometimes we do that with our book groups. So Veterans Read Homer is one way in which we do it. But we also do it through museum tours of the Penn Museum, the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. We also do it through, you know, one-off programs occasionally. We also have another program called Eternal Warrior. And Eternal Warrior took on a life of its own, where veterans created their own sort of virtual directed reading, and they performed it. And so, yeah, that was very, very, that was a very spacious piece of work. So Eternal Soldier tries to take these different aspects of the humanities and just sort of make it possible for veterans to engage. And then because they've been dealing with such precarity in their lives, they tend to have some very, very interesting and profound things. And occasionally they pull up stuff and pull out things where like, whoa, I just didn't think of this small detail with such profundity. But for them, it becomes like, well, I can see how this reflects this aspect of my service. And then we hone in on that and we try our best to encourage them to feel comfortable with what they're exploring and to feel that they can share that with the other veterans in the room. I think we work really hard to make sure that we are recapitulating some of the group aspects of being in the military, because that's what they all know. And some of them have told us point blank, we don't want civilians in these groups. We want these groups to be with other veterans. And so they do. They see themselves as very separate. But at the same time, they're trying hard to understand what it means to be a civilian. Both in terms of like what they were fighting to protect when they were active duty, and also how to make friends with being a civilian as they step down from active duty. You know, and for some people, that change is very, very abrupt and difficult. Others have a much better time of it. And so, and we've gotten all types in Eternal Soldier. We've run into all types. One thing I did want to point out is that in the same way, Bridget, you were saying that Greek society was so polarized, we could say the same thing about our military's culture with the men and women that serve, extremely polarized, and their expectations from service and also some of their observations about service are very, very different. I think some of them would be very difficult for a civilian to hear at times. And even the VA struggles to encompass what it means to be a woman veteran. So it is, it's a very, you know, like I said, it's a moment of precarity for, you know, in multiple
ways. It's such an irony because I think so much of the polarization in antiquity has to do with the nature of warfare at that time. And now that we actually, you would think we had like completely transcended the conditions that created such a polarized society. Now that we have women fully serving in our military. And yet, it's clear that those issues have not gone away.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Well, as long as patriarchy remains the main frame through which our culture organizes itself, I don't think it
right.
will go away.
So I think that's why the humanities are so important, because they're about cultural frameworks and ideas and ideologies rather than about material conditions. So the conditions mm-hmm. can change such that women are serving in the military, but if the basic attitudes and assumptions are the same, then nothing significant or things still haven't changed as they have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we're going to have equality, that's certainly the case.
What I found so interesting about what both of you said here is because I've had Amanda Huffman on the podcast, and she is a veteran who runs a Women of the Military podcast. And something that she said to me when I asked her about, because she said she began her podcast by just gathering stories from veterans. And she said to me that she found women who served were far more eager to talk about it. Like to say, I would like to develop and tell my story of service here. Whereas the men that she contacted were not rude in any way about it, but a lot less willing to create a story and work on the story. Do you find that even in the Eternal Soldier program?
Oh, that's very interesting. In some ways, this would be only speaking very roughly.
Right.
I would say there is some truth to that the male veterans are more likely to be kind of asking questions about, you know, the material conditions of warfare in the Homeric age, or about ancient history. And slower. I mean, not always. And like I say, this is a very rough generalization.
Yeah, we're generalizing.
While the women, I think, are overall quicker to make a connection to a personal experience between the text and a personal experience.
I would back you up with that, Bridget. But I also think that sometimes our men veterans are looking for like some sort of objective truth that they can latch onto as opposed to a subjective truth. And that makes it harder to engage with the material sometimes until they realize that we're interested in both. You know, if you have some objective wisdom, great. But if you have some subjective wisdom, share it. We're all ears, you know. I do believe that Eternal Soldier has certainly made me a better able to work with veterans at the VA, that's for sure. And vice versa. You know, working at the VA has made me really, really come to Eternal Soldier with a kind of compassion that I don't think I would have had otherwise. But I also want Eternal Soldier to become something that works well for both men and women veterans, because their needs in some ways are different. And, you know, again, some of their experiences are very different. You know, for example, women veterans are very much interested in more stories that reflect the home and the family and being a woman veteran who's serving, but who's also trying to maintain this. So it's a kind of, you know, second shift on steroids. But also there's a desire for their heroism and the, you know, the roles that they serve in to be brought out to the fore, and what does it mean to be a woman who's, you know, really participated in combat, even though, you know, that's still in, you know, technically something that women veterans are not supposed to be doing. But they're, you know, if they're doing logistics, they're still doing it. You know, they're still on the battlefield. So we, you know, the ways that we're thinking about these things, I think, are telling, because it, you know, I think for a lot of men veterans, you know, patriarchy doesn't give them many, many different ways to think about themselves. And, you know, but for women, the more that women are empowered to speak, the more, you know, the better the ways that they think about and talk about their service. So empowering women to speak, and perhaps, you know, empowering men veterans to, you know, feel to grasp their own subjectivity and the wisdom that's in that, I think would be, you know, are definitely two things that we work on, even when we don't label it that way.
Yeah, I, you know, way back when I taught a world lit course and we looked at the Odyssey, and one of the essay questions that I asked my students if they wanted to write about is, I taught half of the Odyssey from the perspective of Penelope as epic hero. And I wanted to see what the students would do with it. And so I offered this as the essay question was, how is Penelope essentially just as much the epic hero here of the story? And I was shocked, a little bit shocked to say, not only did a majority of the students choose that question among things, you know, having to do with, you know, the Iliad and the Aeneid and all that stuff, but I found quite a few young men really diving into that. And they loved making the connections here, say, to the epic hero, and finding how very much she serves in that same function. And of course, the war. They spoke a lot about the war that she's in with the suitors and all of that, and even the battle just to try to keep her son alive during all of this. And so you made me think back to that moment. I hadn't thought about it in so long. And definitely speaking with Amanda Huffman also, she opened up my eyes to a lot of that stuff too, how very specific. There are both specifics and universals that we can talk about, you know, when it comes to women in the military and soldiers in general. And actually that kind of serves as a nice segue here too. Something that I loved when I went to the website of Eternal Soldier is that I got the sense that it transcends a lot of the, I'll call it political ties that tend to be attached to the soldier from specific conflicts. So in other words, it's not a program just for veterans of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars or from Vietnam or World War II or anything like that. It seeks to create a balance between the individual experience and the collective history of the human in conflict. And I want to just read a very, very brief quotation from the website because I think it puts it beautifully. We point out the uniqueness of contemporary veteran experience, but simultaneously, we place that experience on a continuum. Our goal is to empower veterans and help them see that their experiences may differ in detail and technological features, but their emotional, spiritual, and psychological experiences have a timelessness that unites all warriors. Now, I have two questions here. A little bit. It's beautiful, beautifully written. I would like to ask two questions. What are, in your opinions, the experiences that unite the veteran in history? And is there significance in the use of the word warrior here?
I wrote it.
Oh my goodness, you're fantastic. Can you teach my writing class? That's phenomenal.
Well, thank you for that compliment. I was searching for a way to, as you said, bring out the humanness and lift our modern, and to get past the modernity of the people we were going to be working with. But also to recapitulate that many of the things that they're struggling with are not new, and that people have been writing about the fear, the heroism, the turmoil, how hard it is to put down your weapon and go home, what is peace, and you know, the peace that only comes after you've been fighting and people are exhausted versus the peace that's imposed upon you. Those are all questions that human beings have been struggling with for millennia. And so I wanted that to come across. But some of that is dictated by my work at the VA, where veterans struggle with isolation and they struggle with feeling that they are the only one to have witnessed something horrible on the battlefield. And they also struggle with trying to, again, put subjective labels on things. And they doubt their own critical thinking skills. I also feel that veterans, some of them, you know, feel tainted. And they struggle with coming home and you know, being in civilian world. And that our civilian world does very little to value and reward them. So there's a lot of messages in that phrase that I was trying to convey where I wanted the veterans that we're reaching out to feel like they were joining a community.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in what Max has said. Thinking about this, I'm just thinking of some of our recent discussions and a couple of themes that keep coming up that I think are really universal. And one has to do with the challenge of being away from home and knowing that time is passing. And that's really something that the Odyssey is all about, that things are changing at home. And yet being kept sort of alive by memories of home that, you know, are not changing. And just the fear, I mean, you know, the whole sort of Odyssey's plot with the suitors who've taken over Odysseus's home, I mean, which have their kind of modern day counterpart in this Joey figure, you know, that we were talking about. And is that the name? No, it's Joey, right?
Jody,
right, sorry, yeah. And just that, I think, as a kind of source of constant anxiety is one thing that I think speaks really, really powerfully. The other thing, and I think this is just an absolutely unavoidable issue in any military situation, is the relationship between leaders and their followers, and crises around leadership are there are certainly integral features of the Homeric epics that I think, everyone, whether in a leadership or position or not, has struggling with a leader, has had to contend with.
Mm-hmm. I would just add to that too. We've had these moments in Veterans Read Homer. We've been doing this. This is our 10th group, Bridget. Oh, I know. So we've been doing a lot of these groups. We've met a lot of veterans. Some have worked with us more than once, for several years even. So, we get to dig into some stories with them. And often, this whole idea of the suitors being Jodies and the anxiety of that can create. Do you know what I mean when I say Jody, Joe Meyer?
No, please. And please tell the, I can kind of understand from around the context, but please tell the audience exactly what you mean.
Sure. So one of a veteran's greatest, or rather an active duty greatest fear, is that somebody is moving in on their relationship while they're away. Okay. And that person is called a Jody. Yeah. And that Jody is, front and center. But it is part of that desire that Bridget was pointing out, of home should stay the same. Veterans have, when they're on service or in country, they have visions and fantasies.
They hold on to this image of an unchanging home. Right. And then they have to return to a home that can't have stood still. It's just not possible.
Precisely. Right. It's not possible. And the Odyssey summarizes that. But one of the things we didn't, that I forgot to point out, was you asked about the term warrior and why warrior. Yeah. So, because most military men and women think of themselves as warriors. So to be a soldier is actually to be more associated with the army. So the different services, the different branches have different terms, and it is a culture, and there's a lot of language surrounding the different aspects of your military service. But being a warrior is what they all are, and they do see themselves as a warrior, not just a soldier. A soldier doesn't always include the heroic. It doesn't always include the glory, and also doesn't include that sense of sacrifice that a warrior may take. And it's also a way of bridging the time gap and bringing a sense of, service and collectivism that I think is missing in some ways from our modern society. We put so much onus on the individual, and we use that mentality for, some political stuff. And again, it's that feeling of isolation. But when we step out and start to think about the collective, then, there's definitely a kind of serenity that can come out of that. And the collective, you can be an Inca soldier, and a way to bring that, that historical and anthropological and archaeological perspective is to make them a warrior as opposed to just a soldier. So it's a way of using a language that I think that veterans recognize.
I love it.
It seems like that's a state of mind or a state of being, while soldier is kind of a role that you've been given, where
complete
you fit into
Bridget.
A certain structure. Warrior is more of an essence that can then transcend time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That makes complete sense to me. Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for taking the time to explain that. I think that that's actually really helpful. You also both made me think of again, this universal and how this just keeps showing up in different times. You made me think about Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings, and how you've got both Frodo and Samwise Gamgee returning from this conflict of trying to bring the ring, right, to mount, you know, Doom and destroy it. And at one point, and this again stuck with me when I reread it about 2 or 3 years ago now, was just what made Samwise able to come back home and rejoin civilization was his complete and utter belief in the home, in the structure that's there. And you might even say, I mean, we could certainly talk about how both of them are going to have certain problems, right? Because you had just mentioned that can also lead to potential distortions as well, because the home, of course, is never the same completely when you come back. But it's such a strong thing for him to have to believe it when he's away, that there is a home and that I am still a part of it. And then I need to be there. Whereas with Frodo, of course, he comes back, he's forever changed by his experience, and he just basically flat out says, this home is not here for me anymore. And both of them, you have to be so careful about when you're talking about real problems, right? You never want, there are a lot of veterans, I would assume, who come home feeling like Frodo and say, this home was not preserved for me anymore. And we have to help them and tell them, no. There is a home here for you, absolutely, and you are very much a part of it, but also helping those who want to keep that image, like Sam, to say, don't expect it to be exactly the same, but understand that you do still want to believe that there's a structure there of support and love and whatnot. And it's just, I hadn't thought about it again until both of you just mentioned it, but it's yeah, very strong to me. Absolutely. Well, I could see the fight.
Can I add something?
Please, of course. Yes.
So for Frodo, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan. And, you know, Tolkien as the great classicist and all that. So, of course, I would love the Lord of the Rings. However, what I wanted to say is that for Frodo also has, he's come away with a measure of shame over his behavior.
Yes.
You know, he wasn't able to resist the power of the ring. And therefore, that feeling of shame, you know, and the, one of the things, Bridget, and you've experienced this, we as the community that needs to welcome the veteran home again, we have to make space for them to be able to grapple with that shame, because that was something that they took on our behalf. All right, they are totally set up to be like, you're going to defend this, that, and the third about the United States. And so when the veteran returns, because there's probably been some shameful acts that will have occurred, depending on how the veteran responds to that, they may need more help from the community. Frodo got no help when he went home. There wasn't somebody saying, you know, let's have a giant party to welcome you back. He just sort of kind of slid into things, still with this degree of shame embedded in his personality. So I'm not surprised that he found it really hard to stay at home, whereas Samwise didn't have to struggle with that. So similarly, you know, we could look at that as something called a moral injury, as a play out of a moral injury. So at our VA in Philadelphia, the Christians VA Medical Center, we have a moral injury group that is really working hard to not only help the veteran understand like their service, but to encourage the community to take upon itself a real ceremony that enables that veteran to return to the community, to, you know, to not be divested of the shame, but to certainly have that shame or the acts that they witnessed or perpetrated or whatever, to have those things be in a perspective.
If I could just throw something in, I've taken part in one of these ceremonies, and they're incredible. It was a really powerful, moving experience. And I think that this involvement of civilians in these ceremonies speaks to one of the most important differences between the ancient world and the modern world, which is that in the ancient world, every man of a certain age participated in the military. It pervaded the society, and everyone was involved in war. And We now live in such a different society where we kind of outsource that to a very small proportion of the population. And we send those people to do things in our name that we don't always own. And so I think a program like that is really important. And dialogues like the ones that we have in Eternal Soldier between people who have served and people who haven't are really, really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Veteran Ben Colloy on my podcast, he said that something that when he was doing his own deep dive into his own story, what he experienced as a veteran, he came across a discussion of a Native American ritual where when they were coming back from combat, they would bring it to the entire society there. Mm-hmm. And it was very important that everyone was there mm-hmm. to listen, just to listen to what happened, what was the story. And he said when he read that, it kind of gave him goosebumps a little bit to think about the idea of the role that we could all play in creating this type of space for them to return and speak when it's the right time for them to do so. Right. So the patience for if they say, I don't want to talk about it right now, one, we don't take it personally. You simply say, okay, I understand. But when they do say, I think I'd like to talk about it, be there and listen. Just listen to it. You don't have to solve anything necessarily. You just have to listen at that point and how important that is. So I love the idea of this moral, say it one more time, a moral...
Moral injury group,
I think is fantastic. And even to close the loop a little bit on Tolkien here too, you made me think about the fact that of course Frodo actively, he takes it upon himself, but he does so because there's a problem with everyone else. They won't do it. They can't do it even.
They can't do it.
Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when he comes back home, there are very few people from which he can even share that kind of story with. And nobody, yeah. You're right, that nobody can really open up. Nobody opens up and listens to him or is even willing to listen, and how much of a problem that actually is. Again, phenomenal. I didn't think of it that way either until just now.
Yeah, because, you know, no one thinks that Frodo is a warrior. Mm. But in truth, he is, you know, he definitely is. So, but when it comes to moral injury, I want to stress that, you know, veterans who are dealing with moral injury, they're not just dealing with, you know, some little minor issue that went wrong in their military service. I mean, they are thinking of, they have stories that have made them suicidal. Okay. And the shame that they're carrying is so overwhelming that they feel that it might be easier to take their own life than to try to find a way to live with what has happened to them. And what the moral injury group has done is find ways to get those veterans to strengthen them so that they can live with what they experienced or witnessed or did or failed to do. And so when we're thinking about those kinds of moments then and what the collective can do to welcome that veteran, it may entail hearing some stuff that makes you go, whoa, wait a minute, you know, and then you call into question some of the foundations of our military and our government and, you know, what we're being told and what we're not being told. So I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, this work is not for everyone. It's not to be undertaken lightly. Whenever we're working with veterans, we always have a professional in the room who can guide us in case somebody, you know, finds themselves really in distress because of something that we're talking about. And at the same time, we also know that, you know, our veterans, they do have a resilience. They do have a faith in our country and in, you know, people in general. And so, you know, but those elements have to be balanced.
Yeah. Something that only just a couple more questions. You've both been so generous with your time. Something that may not be obvious to everyone or to others is when you engage in teaching or project like this, you invariably learn something yourself. or even something about yourself. Can you talk, both of you, a little bit about what you've learned as being a part of this program as well?
Bridget, you want to go first?
It's not necessarily in big takeaways. It's just seeing, I think it's seeing texts that I know really well through really different eyes. One of the reasons that I'm really delighted to do this is I love teaching college students, as clearly you do too, but there are also, it would be a shame if these texts were only available to people who are college age, and that as people accumulate experience, they accumulate perspectives that are really illuminating. I just have heard over the years many, many things that have made me think differently. I'll just throw out one example because it's very fresh. Maxwell recognized this as coming from a recent group, a discussion. One of the things that constantly comes up in discussions of the Odyssey is Odysseus as a leader, because he is the hero of this poem, but he does not fulfill the ideals of a modern leader. He really doesn't. He loses all of his men, and he doesn't make the kind of, he doesn't put them first in the way that a modern leader would be expected to do. So we were, I'm sort of braced for, him getting a lot of grief. And me kind of trying to acknowledge that they're absolutely right. And I have a sort of line about, well, maybe better not to think of Odysseus as a hero, maybe better to think of him as a survivor. A veteran said, yeah, I mean, this is all true about what a terrible leader he is, but he never asked his men to do anything he wasn't willing to do himself. And then she spoke about how not only was this something that she thought of as extremely important, but that she had learned from her father, who had also been a soldier, and how that was something he had really instilled in her. And so it was a wonderful kind of turnaround from, because this is where I felt like I almost had to apologize for my ancient hero. And she was showing me a way of seeing him that put him in a different and more favorable light. And that's just one of hundreds of examples of ways in which someone with, I don't think a college student would have the perspective to bring that out of the text, and most college students,
Here, Bridget.
Yeah.
I love that. I do. For myself, the working on Eternal Soldier has been, it's been a labor of love. There's no doubt about it. And I told the story of how I came to thinking about this program, which was, so at one point I was teaching at the University of the Arts, and I was teaching this class on ancient Rome. And I had a student who, we were reading the Aeneid, and she was really, really, she latched onto one of the characters in the Aeneid because he reminded her of her father, who had been to Iraq and had was struggling in the wake of his tours of service, multiple tours. And he, was coming home, he was throwing things, kicking the dog. I mean, his attitude was just really, really hard on his family. But through reading the Aeneid, she started to understand what he might have been confronted with while he was away from home, and how hard it might be for him to come home. And so out of that, and she wrote this glorious paper that the rest of the students loved, this 12-page paper. And we just had such a great moment. It just awakened me to being able to think about the ancient world as a tool, as a way to reach other people. Now, for me, unlike Bridget, when I graduated with my PhD, I couldn't find a job. So that's how I wound up at the VA, because I was like, you got to get some work somewhere. But it just turned out that you know, in the most unexpected way that veterans were like, you have this understanding. Can you share it? Can you tell us more? What about this? What about that? And it's just been like an opportunity for myself in terms of what I've been able to share with people, how we reach other veterans and the conversations that we are able to have. So like Bridget, it's true. There's always a moment where you're whoopsie. There you go. Whoopsie. I don't know what happened, but I got pushed out. I was just going to say that their capacity to surprise. And I was going to say that they have a kind of testimony that many of them want to provide. And I feel like I'm often giving them a chance to provide that wisdom, because they do. Many of them have wisdom. No doubt about it.
Please tell my audience, what are some of the ways that people can help support the Eternal Soldier?
Well, if you're a veteran and you would like to participate in our programs, then hop on our website and you can join our email list. And then I can reach you that way. And you can, you know, learn about upcoming events. We've been doing some of the stuff virtually, so you don't have to be in Philadelphia to participate for some of the things we do. But then, of course, if you are in Philadelphia, hop over to the Penn Museum and, you know, veterans can consistently find unique and interesting and relevant to them.
We're not the only people who do this.
No, we are not.
I mean, we have our own particular mix of things that we do. And we have, our relationship with the Penn Museum makes us very distinctive. But there are people reading Homer with veterans doing around the country. Mm-hmm. So there are other places where you can do this.
Right. And we do owe a debt to our colleague, Roberta Stewart, at Dartmouth.
At Dartmouth.
One of the first people to begin reading Homer with veterans and using it to help veterans understand themselves and their
experience. Yeah, she's really a pioneer in that. So if you happen to be in the Dartmouth area, that's you're really in luck. But there are others in other places as well.
Precisely.
And there are other programs that do similar things. Theater of War is another one, which does more with enactments. But their programs are also fantastic. And now, as one of the positive dividends of the pandemic, that many of them are online. So that would be another thing to look out for.
And then, of course, you can always donate to Eternal Soldier. So, there's a donate button that's really easy to use. So, and those funds would go right to the Penn Museum, and then the Eternal Soldier would be able to use them to grow our programs.
And small amounts can make a big difference. I mean, one of the things that we do is we provide the people in our reading groups with the texts so that they don't have to buy them, and they have a physical copy of the text that we're reading. And so isn't that expensive, but it can make a difference for someone to whether they can participate or not.
Precisely. Yep, that's very true. All of our programs are free. And so, you don't have to pay to be a part of our book groups. And so, and again, if you know of a veteran who would like to participate, you yourself cannot, but you know of another veteran who you think this would be a great outlet for, then pass it on to them and let them know about us. That would always
absolutely wonderful. I love the idea of thinking of your donation too as buying the text for them. Because for some people who need to think of something very physical in their donation,
concrete,
the idea of donating, concrete, you're buying a text for them to read, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Yep. I can't thank both of you enough. I'll be placing a link in the episode notes to Eternal Soldier as well. And I encourage anyone listening to please use that link and go over to the website and go check this out. As I told you in my initial email to you, Max, I find it to be absolutely amazing, just amazing. And I thank you both for the wonderful work that you're doing and everyone involved, of course, in Eternal Soldier. Thank you both very much for being on today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This was delightful.
It was really fun.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Max Brown and Dr. Bridget Murnahan. I know I did. And I encourage you to take some time and check out the absolutely wonderful Eternal Soldier program using the links below in the episode notes, especially if you're a veteran who is looking to make some sense of your service and to find your place maybe in the civilian world. Until next time, try to keep one foot firmly planted on neutral ground. And have a great day.